for our third session of the Spring Institute for Lived Theology. I'm Karen Thiel, and I teach here at USD, and I'm delighted to be introducing to you an expert on U.S.-Mexico border issues in this region. So, Reverend John Fanestel is an ordained elder in the California Pacific Annual Conference of the United Methodist Church. Since 2007, he has held the position of Executive Director of the Foundation for Change, a progressive social justice foundation working in border and immigrant communities of the San Diego-Tijuana region. The foundation makes grants and supports projects that seek to build up this area as, quote, a binational region known worldwide for its economic equality, environmental sustainability, and social justice. And
that's the vision, dream.
From your vision, yes, yeah. That's the dream. Born and raised just north of here in La Jolla, California, Fanestel is a graduate of Dartmouth College, Oxford University, where he studied as a Rhodes Scholar, and the Claremont School of Theology. From 1992 to 2005, he served as pastor of United Methodist churches in Southern California, including 4 years at the bilingual United Methodist congregation in the border town of Calexico. As you may have noticed from the byline on one of your background readings, Reverend Fanestel is also a writer. In 2006, Doubleday published his first book, Mrs. Hunter's Happy Death, Lessons on Living from People Learning to Die. His writing has been featured in the Christian Century, the San Diego Union-Tribune, and many other publications. His paper today is entitled Chasing the Coyote Christ, Border Crossing as Spiritual Discipline. So he'll speak for a bit, and then he'd like to answer questions, so I'll probably moderate the questions, we'll see how that goes, and we'll try to end promptly.
Thank you, Karen, for that kind introduction. I'll begin with two caveats. The first is from a preacher who got into the pulpit and flinched, and at the end of the sermon flinched again, and on the way out, the parishioners asked what the flinches were, and he said, oh, those were the quotation marks. Preachers, unlike academics, aren't accustomed to citing sources, so you'll forgive me if my talk is littered with attributions, some of which you might recognize that I won't myself. And the second one is a sticker that I found and that I actually had on the cover of my laptop while I was writing my first book. And the sticker said, writing one's memoirs is easy when one has a terrible memory. I found myself in my first book, which was filled with stories of parishioners, sort of scouring my files, funeral files in this case, because the stories were mostly tales from the deathbed, stories of parishioners that I had known who died very well. That was the subject of my first book. But I also was scouring my memory and found it often fleeting. So the same applies to what I want to share today, in that it's a composite of memories and a composite of stuff I've dredged up from my own files. And it employs one central metaphor, again, which I suspect I may have stolen from somewhere, perhaps, who knows, from someone in this room, the central metaphor being that of Jesus as a coyote. So I'm going to be reading a little bit because I'm interested to get your feedback on this particular piece, and then I'll share, just in spoken word, some elements from this essay. And at the end, I'm glad to take questions, whether it be about this particular piece or perhaps about Friendship Park, which is what I wrote about for those of you who looked at the advanced materials. I'm sorry I won't get to join you on the border tour tomorrow. You're in excellent, excellent hands with Pedro Rios. But I do appreciate this opportunity for you all as a chance to really get close to the border, as the border is very close to my heart. So this story that I'd like to share with you today originates from my time as a pastor in Calexico, California. Who's been to Calexico? A couple of brave souls. Good. Calexico is a small city 2 hours east of San Diego, just smack dab on the U.S.-Mexico border. Calexico on the U.S. side of the border and Mexicali on the other side of the border. When I arrived in 1992, my first appointment as a pastor in the United Methodist Church, the common vernacular on the street at that time was that Calexico was a town of 20,000 people, and Mexicali, the city on the other side of the border, was 500,000. The numbers today would be something like 35,000 Calexico and 1.2 million Mexicali. So Calexico is, for practical intents and purposes, the northernmost suburb of an enormous Mexican city, and it just happens to be located on the U.S. side of the line. Calexico is 98% Mexican ancestry. Spanish is the assumed language on the streets, even for somebody who looks like me. You wouldn't be in Calexico for any godforsaken reason unless you happen to speak Spanish. So people will simply address you in Spanish on the assumption that you must if you're there. And so I found myself, having done a year of seminary in Costa Rica and had Spanish as a high school student, I found myself immediately thrust into a Spanish language world. My congregation used both languages on Sunday mornings, but through the week, Spanish was the assumed vernacular. So I was forced quickly, and I enjoyed it immensely to be thrust into this world. The Methodist Church in Calexico is on 10th Street. First Street is runs right along the border fence, so 10 blocks from the border. And by virtue of being the pastor, I was also the president of the board of the Neighborhood House, which is a United Methodist mission agency, which is located on 4th Street, four blocks from the border. So my life for those 4 years was utterly consumed by the life of my people, who were border crossers, all, without exception. Some of them one-time border crossers who had made it to Calexico and didn't dare go back for fear of not being able to re-enter the United States, most of whom, though, were living in extended binational families, mixed-status families, visa abuse, whatever you want to call it, sort of rampant, people just floating back and forth constantly and routinely across the border. And as I fell in love with the people, I happened to fall in love with the border as well, even though it drove me crazy. Calexico, the other thing that you have to know about Calexico is how hot it is, yeah? Just brutally, devastatingly, unfathomably hot. Average daily high for 6 months a year, well in excess of 100, 115 to 118, a weekly occurrence throughout that expanse of time. And strategies for dealing with the heat are a critical part of any Calexican's life. And my wife and I, newlyweds, when we arrived, struggled constantly. We were fish out of water culturally. We were fish out of water, it felt, physiologically, because the place was just so damn hot. My own strategy, one of them, was to adapt to a very early morning and late night way of life. And in the middle of the day, you would seek refuge. You would head indoors to nap, to eat, to just get out of the sun. A lot of folks, food, roof, air conditioning were sort of the basic, you know, orders of priority when it came to family expenditures. So even the little poorest shacks on the edge of town would have an air conditioning unit attached to them. Those that couldn't afford even an air conditioning unit would live underground. There would be basements dug out underneath. You know, Calexico is the poorest city in the poorest county in California. Unemployment ranging between 30% and 70% when the fields weren't being harvested. So an extreme environment, and an extreme environment for me in which I found myself struggling. What I did in the early morning hours, though, was I took refuge in the shade of a tree that was in the backyard of the parsonage, the house offered to us as residents by the local church. And there we hung a wicker chair in the shade of the tree, and I would head out there early in the morning to try to beat the heat and to read the Bible and to prepare for the week's sermon and to try to make sense of my life in this peculiar circumstance. Somewhere along the way in those years, it occurred to me to start reading the desert mystics. And so I ended up really immersing myself not just in the Bible, but also in some of the writings of the desert mystics. And this is where I'd like to begin sharing a little bit of this essay with you. Somewhere in my thinking and praying, I was led to seek out the writings of the early church fathers, many of whom were called the desert fathers because they spent their early years in monastic living in the wilderness. Sitting in the shade of the sweet acacia, that was the species of tree, I would read the sayings of Origen and Jerome and John Chrysostom, trying to make sense of their mysterious and mystical experiences. Here were people spiritually acclimated to life in the desert, who had succeeded in cultivating a profound encounter with God. I found myself especially captivated by the story of Athanasius, one of the early church's greatest theologians. Believed to have been born in the year 295, Athanasius came of age in a time of great philosophical controversy. Though earlier generations of Christians had winnowed to four the number of Gospels considered authoritative, the traditions of the church were proving sufficiently diverse to generate a wide range of opinions about who Jesus was and exactly how God had been revealed in his birth, life, death, and resurrection. As Origen had remarked about the Christian movement in the 3rd century, many of those who profess to believe in Christ differ from each other, not only in small and trifling matters, but also on subjects of highest importance, as, for example, regarding God or the Lord Jesus Christ or the Holy Spirit. Known during his early years in the desert as St. Anthony the Abbot, Athanasius entered the doctrinal fray in the year 320 when he took a position as the deacon to Alexander, the bishop of Alexandria. Alexandria was a hotbed of controversy because in that city, a priest named Arius was promoting the view that Jesus had come into being out of non-existence, that he was, in other words, merely a creature of God. Over against this philosophy of Arianism, Athanasius championed the position that the Son, Jesus Christ, was of the very same substance as the Father, God, that he was, in other words, divine and eternal. This understanding was formalized at the Council of Nicaea in 325, a gathering of church leaders in which both Alexander and Athanasius played critical roles. The creed endorsed at the council read in part, "We believe in one Lord, Jesus Christ, the only Son of God, eternally begotten of the Father, God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, of one being with the Father. Through him all things were made. For us and for our salvation he came down from heaven. By the power of the Holy Spirit he became incarnate from the Virgin Mary and was made man." The Nicene Creed was a resounding rebuke of Arianism, and Athanasius' view became the standard for Christian orthodoxy. For Athanasius and other church leaders at Nicaea, this doctrine of the incarnation was of paramount importance because it had profound implications for basic questions about the nature of human nature and the possibilities of human existence. Athanasius made any number of attempts to illustrate what he saw as the practical implications of the Orthodox creed, specifically that through the saving work of Jesus Christ, the gap between God and humankind could be bridged. His most famous assertion, you've heard it, right? God became human so that human beings might learn how a human being can become divine. You've heard that, yes? God became man so that man might learn how a man can become divine. The story of Athanasius and the making of the Nicene Creed struck a series of chords deep in my soul. It occurred to me that in Athanasius' worldview, God crossed a supernatural border by taking on human flesh in Jesus Christ. And more than this, Athanasius, Jesus, had lived on both sides of this border, at once fully human and at the same time fully divine. Finally, the way Athanasius thought about it, and this was the most radical thought of all, Jesus had called people to follow him across the border between heaven and earth, to share with him his spiritual communion with the divine. Jesus was a coyote for God. Of course, there was a part of me that rebelled against this way of thinking about Jesus and the life of faith. I had been on the border long enough to know that most coyotes are untrustworthy characters. Also known as polleros, chicken herders, they are as notorious for exploiting their pollos as they are for helping them. Surely Jesus should not be compared to characters as unsavory as these. But then I recalled that when Jesus said, "I am the good shepherd," according to the Gospel of John, he drew explicit contrast with the unsavory shepherds of his day. I imagine that in our day, Jesus might say, "I am the good coyote." The good coyote lays down his life for his pollos. Cast in this light, the metaphor came alive. As I began to think of Jesus as a coyote, inviting people to follow him across the boundary between heaven and earth, a whole host of Jesus' sayings, as they are attributed to him in the Bible, took on new meaning and added depth. "Follow me, Jesus, the coyote Christ says, and take heart, it is I, have no fear. Take nothing for your journey, no staff, nor bag, nor bread, nor money. For truly I tell you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you. Enter through the narrow gate. The gate is narrow. The road is hard that leads to life. I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. I will go and prepare a place for you. I will come again and will take you to myself, so that where I am, there you may also be. You are not far from the kingdom. And as I reflected on the words the Bible attributed to Jesus' disciples, I could not help but think of the many thousands of Mexicans who chase their very human coyotes through the desert while crossing the border into the United States. Where are we to get enough bread in the desert? Where do you want us to go? They were just now trying to stone you, and you're going over there again? What do you mean, saying a little while and you will no longer see me? I will follow you wherever you go. The vision of Jesus as a good coyote, the coyote Christ, was for me extraordinarily liberating. Suddenly I came to see my own circumstances in the larger perspective of faith. At the end of the day, my challenges were much less severe than those faced by so many people on the face of the earth, including my own parishioners in the little Calexico church. Born and raised in La Jolla, an Ivy League graduate, a Rhodes Scholar, I was in Calexico as a missionary. Leaving was always an option for me. What are the poorest of my parishioners, whose families were tied by force of hard circumstance to the border? What of them? As I recast this vision of Jesus as a spiritual coyote, a coyote extraordinaire, I came to see that people like those I was coming to know in Calexico were in a whole host of ways more like Jesus and his disciples than I was. In my life and work on the U.S.-Mexico border, I was being given intimate access to the spiritual journeys of people whose lives crossed borders of language, nationality, culture, and class. I was being given the opportunity to learn lessons on life and faith from people for whom border crossing was a way of life. As I began to look anew at the people I was coming to know in Calexico, my own self-understanding changed. Instead of thinking myself as their pastor, I began to think of myself as their companion. And as I took my place beside them, as if in a great adventure, a great journey, it dawned on me that there on the border, they were teaching me to cross the line. Athanasius was fond of metaphors. His writings are replete with metaphors. And the metaphor of the coyote Christ is, like any metaphor, approximate and incomplete. A favorite saying of mine is from Wendell Berry, who said, where is it? When Jesus said, I am the door, he did not mean to claim that he had hinges and a knob. But Jesus was constantly resorting to metaphor too, wasn't he, to try to explain to his disciples who he was, so that Jesus, again and again and again, when pressed by his disciples to identify himself and explain himself, to account for his crazy behavior, would resort to metaphors. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the true vine. I'm the way and the truth and the life. John, especially, the Gospel of John, is one metaphor piled upon another as Jesus attempts to interpret to his followers. And, of course, I am the good shepherd. The early church fathers followed suit. Athanasius also, in trying to argue his case against Arius, resorted at the end of the day to metaphor. Jesus was like a king who, after sending letters to his rebellious subjects, determined to visit them in prison. Jesus was like the sun, which is not defiled by touching the bodies upon the earth, he wrote, nor is it put out by darkness, but on the contrary, itself illuminates and cleanses also. Jesus was like a noble wrestler who conquers all foes, earning the respect of the onlooking crowd. And perhaps his most famous metaphor of all, Athanasius compared Christ to a subject returning to sit in an artist's studio for the renewal of a portrait. This is what he wrote. We were made in the likeness of God, but in course of time that image has become obscured, like a face on a very old portrait, dimmed with dust and dirt. And when a portrait is spoiled, the only way to renew it is for the subject to come back to the studio and sit for the artist all over again. That is why Christ came, to make it possible for the divine image to be recreated in man. We were made in God's likeness. We are remade in the likeness of his Son. Athanasius and the early church fathers understood a simple fact. Metaphorical reasoning is essential to the pursuit of faith. Every sermon ever preached and every prayer ever spoken has attempted to put words on truths that are larger than the words themselves. And again, across the course of history, the followers of Jesus have resorted to metaphor in attempting to account for their experience of him. In word and image and song, Jesus has been portrayed as a judge, a physician, a captain, a superhero, a revolutionary, a peasant, a worker, a boss, a lover, a dancer. The list goes on. Of course, some metaphors are better than others. But at root, the question is not whether to live by metaphors, but rather by which metaphors will we live. So I believe that the metaphor of Jesus as the Coyote Christ is an extraordinarily helpful one, specifically for people who are facing borders of whatever kind. A root flaw with the metaphor of Christ as Coyote here on the U.S.-Mexico border is that the implication is that somehow the United States is heaven. Of course, Mexicans know better than that, describing themselves as, you know, tan lejos del cielo y tan cerca a los Estados Unidos, so far from heaven and so close to the United States. So this metaphor is approximate and can't be taken too far, but I find it very helpful. The idea that we can live on both sides of the border that lies between heaven and earth, it's a bedrock philosophy of Eastern Christianity, but it's largely unfamiliar to the contemporary Western mind. But across the ages, it sprouts up here and there in the more mystical branches of the Western Church's family tree. For the most part, though, modern Western Christianity has been shaped by the Protestant emphasis on a corrupt human soul, the absolute sovereignty of God, and therefore tended to dwell on human sin and limitation rather than on power and potential of the human spirit. Most Westerners are inclined to think of the heavenly realm as distant and remote if they think of them at all. But I believe the metaphor of crossing borders, chasing the Coyote Christ, can be of great help. In this age of postmodernity, though we may be awed by the powers of reason and science and technology, we recognize that the modern scientific worldview is incapable of answering deeper questions about meaning and the purpose of life. As the physicist Brian Greene has put it, modern science has proven without peer in answering questions about how the world works, but it does not have answers to the question, to the questions that begin with why. Why is there a universe? Why are we here? Why, as all the world's great religious traditions invite us to do, should we love one another? By scientific method, reason by argumentation, we cannot answer the basic questions of faith. If we are to rise above the modern era, it will have to be by another route. And to travel this route, we will need to follow someone we can trust. We need a good coyote. So it's been now almost, 20 years, 1992, I arrived in Calexico. And It was a long circuitous route that brought me back to the border 5 years ago. My wife and I moved back to San Diego. But it was this experience of living in Calexico, backyard experience of epiphany, if that's what it was, and more practically, the day-to-day experience of living with my people in Calexico that converted me. And turned me into a person who tries to cross the border and the borders of my life that we all have. The other key insight, I allude to it there, but it could be made more explicit. I believe that we have so much to learn. I speak now as a privileged gringo. We have so much to learn. This is the great loss, the great, great, deep loss I feel for churches, to be honest. So many are preoccupied with how to help and what to do, and the thought of what we must give and how we ought to do and what we will bring. And and missing completely the prospect that the greatest gifts to be had in this relationship are the gifts that immigrants will bring to us. The greatest learnings to be had are the ones that we will receive from immigrants whom we welcome into our midst. And that the greatest triumph we might have would be one in which we accede to follow for God's sake. To follow. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts in response to this piece. I wanted to share two quick tidbits just that have occurred to me as I've listened in on the conversations from earlier. One is, I can't remember, somebody can help me, but who is it that said the Bible is a book written by migrants, about migrants and for migrants? Have you heard that? I can't recall who. So yeah, somebody, which I think is germane to our conversation. And the other one is, Madison's gone, but just on this question of nationalism, my favorite line from one of my teachers at Claremont, John Cobb, who is an extraordinary theologian, for those of you who don't know him. But John Cobb has written, I think, most beautifully about nationalism. And he says that sin, that human sin, this gets at the core of idolatry, which has been a theme as well with Professor Espine and Danny, you too. But that idolatry is in fact a very, very close kin to the highest of human aspirations. And that in fact the greatest sins that we to which we are vulnerable are intimately related to our greatest virtues. And that he sees this, John Cobb does, in the love of nation, which is ostensibly the love of a people and a high and noble calling. And yet such a fine line, isn't there, between love of nation or love of one's own people and, of course, the demonization and the hatred of the other. And there's something, I think, very profound in that I struggle with constantly as I talk to peers and friends of mine here in San Diego and elsewhere about immigration and about the border. I find such noble sentiments in so many ways that are this offspring of such vicious and heinous idolatry. That somewhere in there is a turn of spirit or a turn of mind, which gets to your point, I think it was, Professor Espine, that most people are noble or good. They want to be, at least. They want to be. And yet so vulnerable are they, are we all, to these great sins. Thank you. Yeah, and I did that in part because I didn't know if people were interested to talk more about locale, and also because I knew dinner was waiting. But if the U.S.-Mexico border and specifics, you're going to get an eyeful tomorrow with Pedro Rios. But and there are a bunch of other experts in the room, Jamie Gates, Bill Raddatz, and others here who are constant border crossers here locally. So I thought that some of this time might begin to turn our attention toward tomorrow's tour and questions that you might have about the border here in San Diego. Just some thoughts.
I'm interested in the metaphor of Jesus as coyote and how, I mean, is that metaphor something that you use within your community? Or is this metaphor something for privileged individuals to try to understand the plight of the immigrant? Because for me, if you are in their community, is it just a good coyote or model coyote, they might head to, there's this patriarchy that's mm-hmm. there.
Well, I hope I didn't leave the impression that I felt that I was the good coyote. So that was
mm-hmm. you know, you're using a metaphor. Mm-hmm. I guess my first question,
sure.
So does it speak to the community mm-hmm. that you work with? Mm-hmm. Do you use that? Mm-hmm.
No, I haven't. I didn't use that in Calexico, certainly, nor was that. I've preached some of this, but not widely. I'm also not practicing. I'm not a preacher. I don't have a weekly gig right now, nor a congregation that I'm responsible. My full-time job is as a director of a social justice foundation, so I don't have to bother myself with church people too much, which has been fantastically liberating, to be honest. Can't tell you how fantastic it is. To not be responsible for church people. So I don't. This isn't a metaphor that I have implemented in a pastoral vein in any direct way, but it's a metaphor that serves me in my own thinking as I try to chase the Coyote Christ. And it also, what it has done for me is this: that it injects thoughts of borders. I'm very interested in people who are adept at crossing borders. So that my first book, for instance, was stories of people who died extremely well. I was fascinated by people who just, they did that extremely well. They were fantastic at that part of their life. They were the exceptions to the rule, but they died with extraordinary grace and power. And I was intrigued by that. As I was intrigued by some of the people in Calexico, whose stories I tell in many of my other writings, people who have done this immigration thing extremely well, whether a well be some of the ways that Professor Espin mentioned, or whether well be a woman in my Calexico church. I remember very distinctly, first day I went to visit with her as a pastor, she said, I said, shall we talk? I don't even remember which language I said it in. I said, shall we talk in English or Spanish? And she said, ¿Quieres té o...? ¿Quieres limonada? And I said, oh, I'm sorry, I don't think you understood me. I was wondering whether you wanted to talk in English or Spanish. And she said, no te entendí perfectamente bien. I understood you perfectly. You asked me if I wanted to speak in English or Spanish, and I asked you if you wanted iced tea or lemonade. It's the same thing, English, Spanish, iced tea, lemonade. And I asked her, so how long, she said, soy 100% Mexicano y 100% Norteamericano, estadounidense. I'm 100% Mexican and 100% American. She was, you know, those people who are very good at this, many of you are in the room, and many immigrants are this way. Many native-born U.S. citizens are not adept at doing this. They don't get it. They feel threatened and unnerved and freaked out by crossing borders, language, culture, race, geographic, ideological. So I'm very interested in the notion that Jesus is somebody who was an extraordinary border crosser. The Samaritans, right? Women, prostitutes, all the rest, right? Who traveled, who crossed borders, who violated boundaries that others would intend. This metaphor for me drives a lot of my thinking about my own call. And it also causes me to take as spiritual mentors people like that woman, Elena, who offered me iced tea or lemonade. Did that answer your question?
Yes, but I still just am challenged by the kind of an abuseless immigrant. So I guess that's the metaphor that I need to...
So the metaphor, so again, the distinction, though, is that the Coyote Christ would be the good Coyote, as opposed to the Coyote who abuses, the Coyote who liberates, yes, and who delivers. So, what's that?
Like the shepherd.
They're exactly. So as opposed to the shepherds in Jesus' day were notoriously bad characters, and that's why Jesus, in my view, had to emphasize, I am the good shepherd, not like all those other shepherds that you know. I am the good shepherd, the one who will take care, who will lead you to waters, right? So my emphasis on Coyote is Jesus as the one Coyote out of the multitudes who, in fact, we can trust. Yes.
I guess I want to reinforce what that is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes you have to be careful because what might work, explain that to one congregation, which is why I think, again, going back to Teresa's point, is how does this work in your community of accountability?
Mm-hmm.
Because how it works in that context is also to give shape to metaphors, whether they're theological, pastoral, practical, even social policy.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess in that sense, since you had asked earlier for some feedback, just even me thinking or how that piece becomes clearer or more clearly articulated might be something to consider by Vanessa's comments.
Yeah, it is helpful, and I appreciate. Yeah, thank you for those comments, both of them. I haven't written this up exactly, but my friend Victor Clark Alfaro, who runs a center for human rights in Tijuana, is as expert on the subject of coyotismo as anybody I know, because he's been studying it for many years. And he talks about three generations of coyotismo. That at root, coyotes were most often family friends, right, and trusted confidants who had been to the United States before, returned to Mexico, and now were ready to show their fellow citizens the way. A second generation were more like small businessmen, entrepreneurs, who operated in roughly what amounted to a competitive market economy, and Victor Clark's assessment that even in that generation of coyotismo, coyotes, there was a code of honor, a code of business, if you will, that governed. And it's only in the last 10 to 15 years, specifically as we've clamped down on the border through border enforcement policies across the last 15 years, that the trade in pollerismo has become so profitable that criminal enterprise has entered. So that the association of coyotes with abuse and exploitation and violence, which I understand is real, is in fact a fairly recent phenomenon. And all the questions that you raise, I think, are germane. But I guess the notion of a good coyote is not a fanciful or far-sighted idea. There's a long history of good coyotes in Mexico.
I guess I would just push you.
Please.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I value your vocation and your spiritual journey.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I'm like, well, how would that metaphor, mm-hmm. you know, whether, how would that metaphor sit with a Latino or Latina on either side of the border?
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yes.
And so how does that piece relate to this piece of, Jesus as,
And so much of this is, perhaps overly autobiographical. But for me, the liberation entailed and required that I get outside of myself and that I get outside of my home culture, that I get outside of my frame of reference. So my first experience in border crossing had nothing to do with the U.S.-Mexico border, but when I was a junior in high school, my father, who was an academic, took a sabbatical year and took us all to Cambridge, England. And I didn't want to go. I was 16, and all I really cared about at that time of my life was basketball. And I didn't know a lot about England, but I knew they didn't play basketball in England. And so I went kicking and screaming, and I lived that year as an outcast. I was the only American at a school, and I was teased by my peers, and I was very much the outsider, first time in my life. And, of course, that experience proved to be fantastically liberating in the long haul. It was excruciating and painful for a teenage boy, but it was what liberated me, to be honest, from some of my own shit. So this notion of border crossing as spiritual discipline for me is the notion that folks who confront borders, and I'm thinking metaphorically again, but who confront borders and cross them with grace and cross them with that this is a spiritual practice or a spiritual discipline that, in fact, can serve us well, serve some people well. I'm not trying to be overly prescriptive, but I know from personal experience can serve some people well. So that I think if living here in San Diego, I mean, some people joke the real border is not the border, but Highway 94. I mean, you know, people where I grew up who quite literally have never been south of Highway 94. I mean, it stuns me, but it's absolutely factually true that there are enormous numbers of San Diegans who have never been south of a certain boundary line in San Diego. So for my mind, spiritual border crossing as spiritual discipline is a challenge perhaps to the, and we're into, I guess, the, the pedagogy of the affluent. Maybe that's an answer to some of your questions too around pedagogy and education. But the necessity to cross borders and to get outside of one's own head or one's own context is for me central. If I'm thinking about liberating my own people, then that I think of as part of what, you know, the challenge is. Does that get at some of your? The death and dying piece is very interesting to me too, for part of the same reason. So, yeah, I mean, people who have that expectation of crossing over, and rise to meet their death, which I've seen, and I'm sure many of you have as well, is quite a powerful thing. And I think it's suggestive of if we want to talk theology, we're getting its doctrines of perfection. Which, as a Methodist, find myself more and more deeply rooted in holiness traditions. The doctrine of Christian perfection is, I think, at play here. I think some Eastern Christian concepts of mystical communion with God is at play here. And I think that border crossing as spiritual discipline is that which drives us to seek out those transformative experiences where we're taken beyond. Was it the known to the unknown? Was that yours, Professor Espeen? Known to unknown is a good frame. I jotted it down to my mind of what I'm talking about when I talk about border crossing as spiritual discipline.
Yeah, I was just going to respond to that or continue the conversation about metaphor. Again, I don't know if that's my thought. I mean, there's one metaphor that when I'm teaching the book of Hosea, which is interesting, in chapter 5, God says he's a moth. I never heard a sermon on God as a moth. Hosea is full of metaphors. But as I hear you give your examples, they're all examples, and they're all, which is okay in my mind, though I agree with them. God may get fun on your end. Maybe because I'm a half-breed, some metaphors work on my Anglo side and some don't work on my Guatemalan side. And that metaphor works for you as an Anglo. And so I can appreciate its limitations. Mm-hmm. Just like at that moment in history, Hosea is using metaphors that wouldn't work in other times and places or for other audiences. He picks this odd one about a moth. The Coyote one may be helpful for you. That's okay.
Sure.
I'm thinking of Anglo audiences, and it's interesting to play with that metaphor to push them into new areas of thinking. But I'd be very hesitant to give it to the Latino audience, but I can see where it could be helpful.
Well, it is interesting. I wrote this while I had played with this metaphor while in Calexico. I wrote this long after, looking back on my time in Calexico. I didn't preach this nor use it as a paradigm for my ministry in that place at that time. By the same token, I would say that as I think back about some of my people in Calexico, many of whom are still living there, one of the great sources of pain and suffering for people along the border is how fundamentally the character of the border has changed in the last 15 years. I mean, the association of crossing the border with pain and suffering and death is not historic. It's just not. the border has been being crossed for centuries and a century and a half since the U.S. imposed a boundary. And for the vast bulk of that time, people crossed the border routinely. It was a common, expected journey for many young men, and the assumption was that one would go back and forth multiple times. And there was great exploitation and risk that one faced in the United States, of course, at the hands of unscrupulous employers, et cetera, et cetera. But the notion that, crossing the border is itself going to be this brutal experience is really a fairly recent phenomena. De acuerdo.
So all depends if you're putting, you know, the border from the perspective of a North American on a wall.
Yeah.
So that is not necessarily the reality, you know, for many of our brothers and sisters in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
I think the metaphor would be much easier for me to embrace if I would look into the price that is paid.
Into the... Sure.
And it's a spiritual journey because with all the migrants that I have encountered in the desert and after being abused in the United States, God is always present.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I got here, they're going to turn me back home, but gracias a Dios, estoy
bien. Sí, sí, sí. Entendido. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So the metaphor can work with me.
Tell
the coyote is ready to pay the price.
Yeah. Yeah.
In order to be able to pay this coyote to give me an incomplete dream.
So on the thank you for that. And I wanted to be clear, I wasn't suggesting that there was no pain in association, there was no pain associated with the border until recently. Whew. And, you know, not by long shot. But I return to my assertion, which is that for the vast majority of the history of the U.S.-Mexico border, Mexicans crossing into the United States have not found it overly difficult or overly costly to do so. And let me share with you the price, as reported by Victor Clark Alfaro, who's been on the work doing human rights work in Tijuana for 30 years. In 1990, the price of from Tijuana to Los Angeles, he tells me, was $25. In 2000, the price was $250. And today, the price is $3,500, common currency on the street. So what he asserts has happened is that a common routine practice of coyotismo, which was a guide, somebody who knew the way, who the Border Patrol was easily evaded, and with a trusted coyote, one could gain access without great trouble. And that has been transformed precisely by our enforcement of the border into, we've made it more difficult, more costly, and of course more dangerous to the point of death crossing the border by our policies of enforcement. So,
you can stay here, you know, keep challenging each other, but, you know, once again, 25 cents to go back into my own land, that's painful for me.
Uh-huh.
It's humiliation. To have to pay somebody to bring me into what was the land of my ancestors, a land and a position that was supposed to be guaranteed by Tratado de Guadalupe, and they manipulated and denied. I mean, even if I have to pay a penny, there's something I'm suffering the fact that I have to pay to go back into the land of my ancestors and be humiliated and rejected. So that's my point. But I
don't. Good.
We're running short on time, but I see a few more hands up here. We can always continue over. Minus, I think you've already said this, but to reiterate it, for people, the majority that are not forced to cross, I mean, it's the people that are forced. Hmm. And the people that choose, they don't even think of it as an option.
Hmm.
So when I hear this metaphor, it's really a discipline. I mean, I see it in your way too as a possibility for people that are oppressed, but my sense would be for the oppressors who don't.
And that might be, yeah, so pedagogy of the affluent.
And I think that's part of what goes back to what you were saying about it being a very personal narrative that you were sharing. So it was your personal, you know, obviously, Anglo perspective, which is a valid one in this conversation, but not necessarily translatable as well.
Yeah, and so the when I've written this up, thinking of it as a series or a book, the subtitle of my first book was Lessons on Living from People Preparing to Die. And what I observed in that was that again, most people, when they approach the deathbed, most Anglo mainline Protestants are frozen by the thought of what could I say, what would I do, I must be in ministry to somebody who's dying, and they don't know how to do it, or they maybe got some training somewhere and have some ideas about how they're going to go be in ministry. And I tell stories from the history of the church, the martyrs, right back to Jesus, and then stories of tales from the deathbed within the Methodist tradition, in which the assumption was that one went to the deathbed expecting to receive a lesson from the person who was dying. That's why last words were so popular. The assumption before the advance of modern medicine, the assumption in Western Christendom, at least in the branch that I'm familiar with, was that people who were dying were actually very much closer to God, right? They were about to meet their maker, and one went to the deathbed expecting that they might share back words of wisdom, right? What did they see? They might see angels. There might be utterances. They might have visions. And people went to the deathbed. They didn't have enough medicine to know what to do about anything. They didn't go presuming they could do anything. And they went to the deathbed actually wondering what the dying person might teach to them. The subtitle for some of this would be Lessons on Living from People Crossing the U.S.-Mexico Border. It is an Anglo, and this is a helpful frame, you know, because what I learned firsthand in Calexico was that I was learning a tremendous amount more from my parishioners than I was teaching them, and that my ministry with them, I pray, was helpful in some fashion. But what I know for a fact was true was that their ministry to me was transformative. So this is a helpful reminder on many fronts of the frame of reference.
I have a locale question. I find San Diego very interesting.
Yeah.
On one hand, it is this profoundly military town.
Yes.
As a county, it's a dominant Republican.
No more. Majority Democrat. More registered Democrats than Republicans in San Diego County.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. But well, historically, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
But then you have this large immigrant community.
Yeah.
You have the work that you do and the advocates you work with.
Yeah.
Tell me about life in the border between those two sides. What's the challenge?
Between the conservative and...
Yeah.
So San Diego is being transformed by demographic changes. One-third of all San Diego households speak a language other than English at home. It's a majority-minority county. 30% Latino, 11% Asian, 6% African American, 5 or 6% other. It's one of the major refugee destination spots for refugees from Iraq, from Somalia, an enormous Filipino and Kurdish population, for instance. So it's a spectacular diverse county. It is now more registered Democrats than Republicans, though the number of independents is also growing. And it's sort of turning into a swing county when it comes to California state politics, so that a lot of folks who are interested in statewide political agendas have figured out that, in fact, the geography of California, the demography, is basically a third of the population of the state of California is north of Los Angeles, a third of the population of California is in Los Angeles, and a third of the population is to the east and south of Los Angeles. So you can look at four Southern California counties, San Diego, Riverside, Orange, and San Bernardino, that have over 30% of the state's population. So it's boomtown in terms of it's the fastest rate of demographic growth. The demographic growth is being driven by Mexican and immigration and other patterns of immigration. And it's fundamentally changing the character of the place. Though most San Diegans, again, who live where I grew up, would be in complete and utter denial of those changes. So working at the intersection of all that I find really fun. And the people I get to work with are fantastic. I really enjoy, and again, I just enjoy it a hell of a lot more than I ever did working with church people. So. No, thank you.
But it seems to me to capture the exhausting journey of the spiritual life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you, and I appreciate the challenges that will force me to continue to think. I guess the challenge back, I would, as again, we've heard again and again that the spiritual life as a pilgrim journey, yes? So if not Coyote, I would say what? Right? If Coyote is not the appropriate metaphor, what is Jesus? If we are pilgrims, what is Jesus? If we're on a journey. Please.
What do people without feet think of the relevance of the image of a god who kneels down to wash your feet? It's like asking in a black community, Jesus is the good slave trader. For crying out loud, ask the slaves.
Yeah.
Theology is not books talking in books. It is reality trying to be thematized by people who have had the luck of being trained in this rare craft. So where are your feet? Where is the community that says this is our faith? As an immigrant, I came in an airplane, so it's not a coyote. But nevertheless, I am married to an immigrant who came illegally. I would have to do so many marabarismos in order to find that, yes, I can find it. But it wouldn't pop up. So if in Carlsbad, if it works, hooray, use it. If in La Jolla it works, please use it.
That's helpful. I will go back to talk to Victor Clark Alfaro, who, if you were to visit with him in Tijuana, would introduce you to Coyotes as one of your first introductions to Tijuana. Hey, old school Tijuana. Old school. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. Yeah. He would challenge me in the same way.
Where do you play the page? Is as important as which instruments you use?
Very good. Thank you very much for that. Thank you all for your comments and questions.
Thank you.